Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Here we are already at the third hour of the program. During this hour, Suzanne Venker joins us. We'll continue our daily series with her on working mothers. We've been dealing with the myth that she outlines in her book, Seven Myths of Working Mothers. Today, I could balance work and family if I had more support. We're going to talk about the whole it takes a village mentality. You know, there is a kernel of truth to that. We'll be talking about the truth in that statement as well as how it is misused by feminism during the first half of this last hour of Issues, Etc. Brad Miner will join us to round off our program. He's a former literary editor for National Review. He has written a new book for, I think it's Spence Publishing, The Complete Gentleman, The Modern Man's Guide to Chivalry. We're going to talk about the hit movie Troy and the gentleman in that film. Brad Miner will be our guest in the last 25 minutes of Issues, Etc. Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Suzanne Venker is a former middle school English teacher and author of the new book, Seven Myths of Working Mothers. Suzanne, welcome back.
Hello again, Todd.
Well, Hillary Clinton made famous, although she did not originate the term, it takes a village to raise a child. Give us your assessment of her use of that phrase and how it does contain a kernel of truth.
Sure. Well, I would say that that's another example of taking what is, as you say, a common truth, in this case being that we should all watch out for each other's children, and stretching it to mean something very different, kind of like the having to work concept that we were talking about yesterday. There's no question that that we are dependent upon one another to watch out for our children in that, for example, if you look at the neighborhood that I live in, it's the kind of neighborhood it's hard to come by these days, actually. I'm very fortunate, and there's just a lot of kids, a lot of moms around, and I can have my daughter be over down the street and still within kind of earshot and know that the mom there is going to kind of, you know, watch out for her or replace me for those 15 or 20 minutes that she's over there or what have you. And I depend on her in that way. Now, that's kind of the old school way that most of us grew up. You know, you play in other people's neighborhoods, and you can kind of assume that the mom or dad of that household is around and going to act as a parent figure for the time that you're over there. Okay? That's the kernel of truth that Hillary Clinton is referring to. But the way that it's stretched, or the way in which she's stretching it, is to mean that government should be responsible for taking care of our kids for us. And that is a very, very different picture of the it takes a village mentality. And that phrase goes back to, or it's always referring to African villages. Well, again, you're comparing apples to oranges. They're trying to replace kin, if you will, with strangers. So in other words, daycare, institutions, and government support of those daycares is supposed to be kind of like your alternative family, if you will. So these people who come and go in and out of your life are obviously nothing like the family, the extended family, that phrase refers to.
Okay, someone says, all right, I am a working mother. And let's just say for the sake of argument, I go to work at my company, and my company has on-site daycare. That means my daughter actually comes to work with me. And that's the best of all possible situations because she's just five floors down in the daycare center. And I do occasionally pop in there on a break, and I try every day to go down there and see her during the lunch hour. And then when the day is over, we're back home. And when school starts, it'll be essentially the same situation. How do you respond to this? I've got all the resources I need to balance work
right.
and family. They provided at work for me, on-site daycare.
Right. Well, all that's doing, of course, is making the concept of daycare more convenient for you. Okay, that doesn't change what's wrong with daycare. And I don't know that you want to get in that tonight because I have a whole chapter on that we're probably going to discuss next week.
Oh, just touch upon it a bit.
Okay. When you're talking about daycare and the problems that exist there, for example, there is this constant problem with daycare that is not going to go away, and that is this high turnover. And by that I mean there are caregivers coming and going in a baby's or a toddler's life throughout the course of their time there. And that's even if you're staying in one, I mean, that's assuming you stay in one, I mean, that doesn't even have to happen by moving from daycare to daycare, that's what I'm trying to say. Even if you stay in one daycare, that's going to be the case. That is the most significant problem for infants and toddlers, is this this change of caregiver, because it's not addressing the fact that what infants and toddlers need is that one-on-one with another human being whose investment in him or her is based on a loyal and strong love that cannot be replicated by a paid surrogate and by someone who obviously is not going to be around in the future, unlike mom or dad. So when children are being moved from person to person to person, they are not attaching themselves to one individual, and that is the most critical piece and problem with daycare. So, okay, you have better quality daycare possibly in businesses, let's just say, and that's not even necessarily the case, but it still doesn't change the fact that that is going to exist regardless. So, again, you're kind of moving the daycare idea or concept from it being more of a government thing, and you're trying to move it into businesses and try to have businesses now care for our children for us, but we're still overlooking the problem, the nucleus of the problem. So no matter what kind of quality you're giving or how convenient you're making it, it doesn't take away what's inherently dysfunctional about daycare anyway.
There are two things that you have written, Suzanne. I'd like your explanation of both of them. First of all, you write, over the last few decades, a great social transformation has taken place in America. Where we once coveted the comfort and security of home and family, as well as honoring the work that went into making a home, we have now turned our attention to the world of work, to paid labor. What do you mean by this?
Yeah, that, what you read, is the crux of myth number four. And in that chapter, I talk about, as you say, this social transformation that has moved us away from a focus on family and home as being, I keep coming back to this word, the nucleus of our lives, really, the center. And then work, paid labor, what we do to keep that nucleus going, if you will, is secondary, that our focus and our priority in the past and our understanding of why we're here and what how we're going to get our needs met and our identity met used to be through the home environment. And we are now shifting away from that and believing that we can find the same sorts of things that we traditionally would find in the home in the workplace. And there was a great book, I think I opened that chapter with this book, called Married to the Job by Eileen Phillipson. And the gist of that book is that work is now providing our emotional needs as well as our financial, where in the past, of course, it was strictly, I like to say, what's that phrase? You live to work versus you work to live?
Yes, exactly. That's okay. What I was thinking of.
Okay, so in the past, we absolutely worked to live, and we now absolutely, no question about it, live to work. And that right there is the crux of the problem. And this, of course, this whole philosophy, this move away from the family, has failed. And as evidence of that, there was another book that just came out about 2 months ago called The Progress Paradox by Greg Easterbrook. And the point of his book was that despite our progress, Americans are less happy than they used to be. And I'm tying that whole concept in these two books, if you will, into this concept of working motherhood and how we have pulled away from the home and tried to go in the wrong direction, and then we wonder why we are not happy.
You also write about the fact that instead of taking advantage of the technology and the advances that we have in our society and our culture to devote more time to the important things in life, we've just sped up the pace. You say, although technology could afford us more leisure time, we choose instead to live an accelerated lifestyle. You would think we have learned our lesson by now. You would think we would have realized that our incessant need for things to be bigger, better, and more doesn't make families stronger. It weakens them. But for some reason, we haven't made this connection. Talk more about that.
Right. There's a lot of, I'm certainly not, I didn't come up with this on my own. You know, there's a lot of material out there written about this, the just this subject alone, this concept that technology was supposed to keep us from needing the manpower that we needed in the past to accomplish certain things, and that these things freed us up. If you just look at the time-saving devices that we have today, I think we talked about this the other day, that keep women today, or moms, from having to, you know, be a slave to the kitchen, for example, and how that in and of itself is so wonderful if we take advantage of it and we don't let it drive us out of the home for good. So in other words, the fact that we have all these devices that allow us to do things, you know, in 2 minutes as opposed to an hour, instead of staying at home and embracing the 55 minutes, or I didn't do that math right, but that you gain from that, we've allowed it to make us become twice as productive or move even faster rather than grabbing those extra minutes and embracing them and living in the moment with those extra minutes. Am I making sense?
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of a hard concept to describe, so hopefully I do a little bit better in the book. But that's really what that's all about.
This is Issues Etc. We're talking with Suzanne Venker, our latest in a daily series on working mothers, dealing today with the myth, I could balance work and family if I had more support. And she is author of a new book titled Seven Myths of Working Mothers. What about the fact that mothers have another shift that's taken place? Whereas when the, and this is a little Ozzie and Harriet, but just bear with me.
Mm-hmm.
When dad and the kids came home from their daily outing, say work and school, mom did have time not only to devote to, but enjoy and spend with the kids, unencumbered by the chores because she had done them during the day. It sounds so very simple. Whereas nowadays, all those chores are shoved up into the time where husband and children are at home if she's out in the workforce too.
Well, you're right, Todd, and that, what you just described, is the whole crux of Chapter 4. It describes in detail what I call, it's almost the crux of the book, that really what led me to even write it, in that there was this obvious, as I always say, full-time job, that being raising children and doing all the work that accompanies that in the home, and trying to do something else full-time alongside it, and then we wonder why these two worlds are clashing. And my suggestion, of course, is because we don't understand or appreciate that what our own mothers did, hello, was work, and that there was so much that went into that. So clearly, if you try to shove something else into the same amount of, into the same day, you're going to have this fallout. So the whole chapter number 4 specifically describes exactly what happens to the life of a working mother in detail, right down to what I call, you know, this fallout, meaning that if you're performing two full-time jobs at the same time, what results from that? And your errands, that the things that you were talking about, the household chores, errands, leisure time, friendships, marriages, even time to ourselves, things that we had time for because we weren't trying to shove two jobs into one day, were the kinds of things that allowed us to lead happy, more happy and fulfilled lives. For example, just as a small example, look at just marriages alone, okay? That takes work, as we all know, and all of us who are married know the amount of work involved. It just doesn't take care of itself. Well, where is the time going to come from? It just doesn't exist. And, of course, I'm using that as an example, the marriages, because that's so much more significant than when you talk about, say, errands or household chores, but they all kind of fall into one another. And actually, it was very difficult to write this chapter because there's so much to it. You know, it's a relatively simple concept, as you said, but to describe it was very hard, and I struggled so much with this chapter. It took me, I think, twice as long as any other chapter.
Well, you reduce it finally to three words, less is more. What do you mean?
Right. That's kind of my answer for the problem, meaning that the less that I'm referring to is do not take on that second full-time job. That's what less is, okay? By not taking that on, you will have more because, as you say, throughout the day, you are able to accomplish all of those things that working mothers are simply not able to do because they're doing something else. So they're shoving in what you're doing Monday through, what a mom is doing Monday through Friday, you know, from sunup to sundown, into the evenings and weekends. Well, obviously, then, what is a full-time mom going to be doing in the evenings and weekends that the working moms and fathers, this is both of them now, can't? Well, there's plenty of things. I mean, the most significant being leisure time, time to ourselves, focusing on our marriage, putting the kids to bed at a reasonable hour so that you can have a conversation with your husband, because too many people are keeping their kids up because they haven't seen them all day. So then you've got that. I mean, there's just so many. It's just this this ripple effect, really, that has happened. And there are, it's so much of it is just common sense, but I'm not sure that it's been put down in paper in this way before, and I think that's probably what makes this a little bit unique.
I remember as a parish pastor doing premarital counseling, and I had the big six. I don't have six fingers on my hand, but there are six things that I could tick off. And I always said, look, there are going to be six things that all married couples will fight about to one degree or another, and each couple is a little different in the mix, the way they put these things together. And some of them won't fight about one of these things or two of these things at all, and some of them will fight about all of them. And if I remember them off the top of my head, there was sex, there was money, there was kids, there was family, by which I generally meant in-laws.
In-laws.
Religion? No, not so much religion. I can't remember the fifth one. The sixth one was always division of labor.
Yes, right.
And I told the men, now look, like it or not, today's women expect far more. My dad's generation could come home and park himself on the couch and expect to have dinner on the table. He could be Fred Flintstone if he really wanted to be. But women today expect more, and your wife is going to expect more. The division of labor within the family, and you may be the exception, but the division of labor has changed. Now, feminism said, this isn't all feminism's doing, but they said men need to take on more of this role. Has that necessarily balanced out to make it so that the working mom can do all the things we've been talking about she's unable to do because the dad now is doing the mopping or the sweeping or the diaper changing?
Well, see, now this is another example of taking a reasonable expectation, a reasonable goal, and stretching it to mean something else. Yet again, I'm not an advocate of those days in the past when dad could come home and kick up his legs for the rest of the evening and be served, and you know, and the moms were still doing the bulk of the child rearing. I'm not an advocate of that life. On the other hand, and by the way, I should throw in that we're nowhere near that today, of course. We're very, very different today. So we have made those changes that women wanted to be made. The problem is, okay, that's fine, except that's not going to work if you're having moms go out into the workforce to become that stereotypical breadwinner father of the 50s. Now you're both seeing what happens at the end of the day, and you're both trying to do all of those things together, and it's not working. So I'm all for the way we live today as far as men being more involved in the home front, and I state that very clearly, I think, in my book. But that doesn't mean you can go out into the workforce, because that's not going to help you reach your goal. You will have that goal more reached easier if you are at home still doing the work of motherhood.
I think the picture, and this is perhaps the saddest part of this part of the American dream, it has become a part of the American dream for women, sad to say, is that they will be able to marry well and then at the time of their choosing have children while they're pursuing a career, that they will go in their business suit with their nice leather briefcase on the train off to the city, put in a full 8 or perhaps 10-hour day, come home, and because they work so hard, they'll be able to have someone clean the house for them. They'll be able to have the au pair or the nanny. And we see celebrities doing this all the time.
Mm-hmm.
It's become the image of the American dream. What's the reality for our listeners of the working mom?
Well, the reality is the average person cannot afford that nanny, that maid, that whatever. So you're still coming home to what they call, and Arlie Hochschild wrote this, she's the author of The Time Bind, which I should probably mention because I talk about her in this book. But she also wrote a book called The Second Shift. And that book talked about what working mothers were complaining about, that being that they were still coming home, all these years later, meaning now, and taking on the bulk of the child rearing and the household chores still. And my argument is, no, you wouldn't be if, again, one of you, and I really don't care who stays home, quite frankly, but it's never going to be top-heavy with, you know, the men doing it. But at any rate, if you're only going to have what you want, as I said, if somebody's at home, they're wanting, feminists are wanting to have that equal division of labor on top of both being in the workforce full-time. But it's not that men aren't doing their fair share when they come home and you're left with it. It's that there is no time, period, because, as I say over and over, you've given up trying to do a full-time job and you're trying to squeeze it into a part-time job, if you will. And so you keep running into this wall, and you're not understanding. They're not understanding that that is a result of a time deficit. It's not men and women not being on equal terms anymore. Those days are over. It's about time, and where is it going to come from? And that's, again, the crux of this chapter.
Finally, Suzanne, with only about a minute here before we have to go and conclude our conversation, I mentioned celebrities who live that, or at least appear to live that American dream. Well, recently we heard that Gwyneth Paltrow, actress, has announced that she's going to put her career, which is pretty well underway, on hold to care for her child. Your reaction to that?
Yeah, there are a handful, believe it or not. I can think of some other ones who have done that, older and younger, and they are on the periphery in Hollywood. I mean, they're definitely, not held up as, you know, as something to aspire to. They're not doing something that one should do, for goodness sake. They're doing something odd, if you will. So I think, yeah, of course I think it's wonderful, but I don't know. I don't know how much those things really apply to everyday people anyway, so I don't pay too much attention to them.
Next time, Suzanne, we're going to take a week's hiatus because I'm going to be taking some vacation mm-hmm. here. And when we come back in the coming weeks and conclude our series on working mothers, we're going to take up the myth, I'm a better mom for working, and I cannot help but think about the moment there when you appeared on CNN recently when you asked the question rhetorically, you know, how can a woman be a better mom if she spends 40 or 60 hours away from her children every week, and the person they'd put you up against to debate said, how can't she be a better mom?
I know. How can she not? Of course, they're wonderful moms. Yeah, I remember.
Well, we'll tackle that myth next time we talk. Looking forward to that, Suzanne.
Thanks, Todd.
Suzanne Venker is a former middle school English teacher and author of the new book, Seven Myths of Working Mothers. On Monday, when we return from vacation, a week from this coming Monday, we'll take up the myth, I'm a better mom for working. Now, you can find out more information about Sue Ann Venker's book, Seven Myths of Working Mothers, and you can browse before you buy it at the website for Spence Publishing, www.spencepublishing.com, www.spencepublishing.com, or order the book by calling Spence Publishing at 1-888-SPEN-PUB. It's called Seven Myths of Working Mothers, 1-888-SPEN-PUB. Now, we will be taking a week off from this series. We'll be back Monday, June 7th, and take up that myth, I'm a better mother for working. When we come back, we're going to conclude this 3 hours and this week of Issues Etc. with Brad Miner. Brad is a former literary editor of National Review. He has written a book called The Complete Gentleman, The Modern Man's Guide to Chivalry. Let's take up the issue of men here in the last 25 minutes. We're going to talk about the gentleman in the hit movie Troy. Stay with us.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Jesus tells his opponents in John chapter 5, "You search the scriptures because you think that by them you have eternal life. These are the scriptures that testify about me." What did Jesus mean? Our Issues Etc. book of the month for May is titled, "Why I Am a Lutheran, Jesus at the Center." It's written by Issues Etc. regular guest Pastor Daniel Preuss. For more information on the book, visit our website, issuesetc.org, and click the What's New section. Why I Am a Lutheran is published by Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. What does it mean that Jesus is the Alpha and the Omega? Find out with Why I Am a Lutheran, Jesus at the Center, by Pastor Daniel Preuss. The cost is $12.99 plus shipping and handling. 1-800-325-3040 or issuesetc.org. Why I Am a Lutheran, our Issues Etc. book of the month
for me.
Gays in the Church. What's happening?
Answers with Ken Ham, whose ministry is building a large creation museum near Cincinnati, Ohio. Well, Ken, the issue of gay marriage isn't just one that we see in the secular world now, but it's even becoming a problem in the church. Why are we now seeing churches beginning to condone what the Bible obviously calls sin?
You're right. We do see more and more churches condoning homosexual behavior. In my homeland of Australia, a large denomination voted to ordain gay clergy. And in America, some Episcopal bishops voted to ordain a gay bishop. Many in the mainstream church are shocked at what's happening, but they really shouldn't be. Let me explain. A recent poll showed that of those teens in the church who call themselves born again, only 9% believe that there's such a thing as absolute truth. So I suggest that because most of the church has accepted the belief of millions of years and other evolutionary ideas, generations brought up in the church no longer see the Bible as absolute. Instead, they believe that the scriptures can be interpreted on the basis of man's fallible ideas. Generations in the church have been applying the same interpretive method to doctrines such as marriage. That's why we see such a problem in the church concerning the condoning of homosexual behavior.
Here's another problem the church has been facing: answering questions from skeptics. And perhaps the most asked question we receive at the Answers Ministry is, where did Cain find his wife? For the answer, read his free booklet at answersradio.com.
This is Dr. John Tape with the Media Minute. Your child receives hundreds of media messages every day. Many of these messages are value-laden, and their values are often contrary to our Christian faith. When such messages come on the TV, you might tell your child, turn that off. But remember, you are not always going to be with your child to say that. So it's important to teach our children how to be critical consumers of the media on their own. Explain to your child that as Christians, we want nothing to do with revenge, anger, disrespect, or sexual immorality, real or pretend. Since Jesus died on the cross for us, we are His special people who value love, joy, peace, patience, and kindness. This Media Minute is brought to you by the Christian Media Literacy Institute. Please visit our website at cmli.org.
Issues, Etc. is underwritten in part locally by Bethany Lutheran Church in Fairview Heights, Illinois. Bethany Lutheran is located at 5600 Old Collinsville Road in Fairview Heights. The Reverend Randy Emmons is the pastor. Their phone number, 618-632-6906. 632-6906. Bethany Lutheran Church in Fairview Heights. www.bethanylcms.org. Welcome back to Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Brad Miner joins us for the last 25 minutes of the program. He's a former literary editor for National Review, a novelist, journalist, and biographer, executive editor of Bookspan's American Compass Book Club. We're going to be talking about the gentleman character in the hit movie Troy. Brad has authored several books, including his latest called The Complete Gentleman, The Modern Man's Guide to Chivalry. That'll be the subject for the last 25 minutes of Issues, Etc. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Brad, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Tell us about this character in the hit movie Troy and how he, at least to one degree or another, exemplifies this virtue of the gentleman.
Well, it's important to specify, of course, which character we're talking about. It's really Hector. For those who've seen the film, he's the son of the king of Troy. And he's the sort of spiritual center of the movie from the Trojan point of view. And unlike Achilles, who's the great warrior on the Greek side, who is simply a savage, really, no other way to describe him, nicely played in the movie by Brad Pitt, the big movie star, Hector is a family man, a thoughtful man, a man of restraint and wisdom, and as the in the first big battle scene, as the Greeks are about to attack the Troy and the Trojan army is out in front, Hector gives a little speech in which he reminds them why they're there, what they're going to do. They're going to defend their city, of course, but they're there to honor the gods, to protect their women, and to fight for their country. And really, that is, in some ways, a statement of what chivalry has always been about.
Talk about chivalry as a concept that used to be considered the mark of manhood, the mark of genuine masculinity, as opposed to simply some high ideal that comes down to us in romanticized versions of old stories.
It was once, in fact, I think, the common aspiration of most men. And if there's a great difference between our time and certain previous times in history, American history and in world history, it's that not so many people aspire to be chivalrous. What it was a code of behavior for warriors, because a chivalrous man is first and foremost a warrior. Chivalry is the worldview of fighting men. But these were men whose, as Edmund Burke said, their ferocity was mitigated by gentleness. The code of chivalry directed them to embrace loyalty, generosity, courtesy, honor, and courage. And if a man could do that, he was in a position to have all those qualities which were so distinguished in a man, the power, the strength, even to some extent the savagery, but it was mitigated by this sense that it must be applied to a higher purpose. It must be guided by a higher purpose. And of course, all the knights at the beginning of the history of chivalry were Christian men. And so it was terribly important for them that in addition to having these extraordinary qualities, that they also expressed in their lives a faithfulness.
Where did chivalry go? Did it die? Is it dead, as some have said?
It's not dead, I don't think, but it is—it's pretty sick. For the simple reason that it is simply not the aspiration of most men. Where it went, it followed a curious history, where, as it emerged in the Middle Ages, it began, even as it emerged, to be transformed by various adaptations. They first came from the church. Then it came from a group of powerful women, was modified by something called courtly love. And as you move out of the Middle Ages and into the Renaissance, then it suddenly the need for men on horseback and for men armed and ready to fight began to diminish somewhat, because nations began to emerge. And instead of having what were then called chivalries, literally groups of men on horseback, each of whom was loyal to a particular lord of a particular castle in some particular area, suddenly you had nations, and nations had armies. And so, to some extent, in the code of many military organizations in various countries, the ideas of chivalry were carried forward, but they were still diminished somewhat by being made into rules of conduct for soldiers, and not so much the very strong personal commitment that being knighted, that embracing chivalry once involved. And then, of course, you move further along in time and you come up to the 19th century, perhaps to the First World War, where it was still important to be an officer and a gentleman, the two ideas, the warrior and the man of great manners and learning, and still combined. And then the Great Disillusion sets in for all sorts of reasons. And the idea of these high standards, of these transcendent standards, began to be called into question, as they were in religion, as they were in education, as they have been in just about every aspect of modern life.
What did modern feminism, more particularly radical feminism, do to chivalry and to the gentleman?
I think that the idea of the gentleman and of chivalry had already taken serious body blows by the time the gender feminists, the radical feminists of our time, came along. But to the extent that men would still bravely wish to show those ideals, to show the deference to women, to embrace restraint, particularly as a part of their characters, they're discouraged somewhat, because women seem to be saying to them, please don't behave that way. It's an insult to me if you behave that way. Now, in my view, the modern complete gentleman is someone who rejects that idea. He goes ahead and he behaves the way it is proper to behave, regardless of what's being demanded of him. Having said that, I think it's also the case certainly in the company that I work for, that I show deference to the women who are here in part by giving them what they want. That is to say, if women have expressed to me a desire that I not open a door for them, not let them on the elevator first, well, I respect that.
Is there a female counterpart to the male gentleman?
To the male gentleman, as it evolved, once it separated itself from the idea of the warrior, yes, it would be the lady. And, you know, once upon a time, from the Renaissance, that is to say the 1500s forward, really until the early decades of the 20th century, one of the most popular kinds of books published, maybe the most popular for nearly 500 years, was the Courtesy Manual. And they were written both for young men and for young women, guides on proper behavior, but also much more comprehensive than that, about how to think clearly, about how to listen to music, about how to do a thousand practical things that taught you how ideas of etiquette, for instance, of manners, were really minor morals. They were the great concepts of Western tradition, of Christian tradition especially, made small so that we would treat others with the kind of deference that lets them know that we care enough about them not to assert ourselves too aggressively in the beginning. That's what etiquette's all about. It's a way of relating to strangers. It gives you an opportunity to have a pause as you approach someone. You don't pretend that you're instantly intimate with people. You recognize that there is a distance that has to be crossed, and you're willing to take your time to do that.
I was reading, now this was several years ago, so my memory is understandably vague, but the book was called something like The Radical Nature of the American Revolution. And I was surprised when I started reading the book. It is virtually almost entirely about how the American Revolution was born out of the sensibilities of 17th century gentlemen. Mm-hmm. It talked about what it meant to be a gentleman in, an 18th century gentleman, even though the concept was obviously compromised by things like slavery and other things, and a little bit too much born of capitalist ideals. The U.S. Constitution and our founders, they were trying to enact on a nationwide scale the sensibilities of what it meant to be a gentleman, a nation of gentlemen.
Exactly so. And you know, all their training, all their education, all their experience taught them that, and you see it reflected in the structure of American governance, that restraint is perhaps the most important concept of all, that we need to balance the powers within the government, that individuals need to be restrained. We want freedom, we want democracy, but it's going to be Republican democracy. That is to say, there will be checks and balances on every group in society so that none can dominate. And all of that is possible only if, I think, we all respect the distance between one another.
Now, let's talk about that respecting the distance. Nowadays, it usually only is done in common parlance when you're dealing with someone who is of either an obviously different social structure, financial, or someone who you work for. If you meet the President of the United States, then suddenly all of these things that we don't practice among one another suddenly come into play again.
Yeah,
you're polite. You address him in a respectful manner. You don't call him "Hey George." You refer to him by his title, or at the very least, in a Mr. President, something along those lines.
Sure. Well, and I think people intuitively understand that distance is important in those situations because of the great respect of the office, the great respect with which we meet. You know, whether it's Billy Graham or George W. Bush or the Pope John Paul II or whoever it might be. But what we need to remember is that that's the right relationship with everyone. That's the approach that we should take to each individual that we're meeting, especially for the first time. It takes time to get to know people. It takes time. And another aspect of chivalry and of etiquette that is so important is that it allows the self, the individual, the person, to be restrained somewhat so that you're not in somebody's face right away. I was home for a decade raising my sons before I came back into the corporate world, which I did just last year. My sons are older now, and so I felt like I could come back and get back into the corporate jungle. I was amazed in the passage of that decade to come back and see the way, especially a lot of young men in my company dress, the way they speak not only to me, whom they don't know very well yet, but to complete strangers who come into their lives as a consequence of business. They think that that's not important, that I'm being overly fussy about these formalities. But I try and make them understand that the formalities are actually an expression of compassion, and that their utter casualness is an expression of egoism. And that if you step back for a moment and put it in perspective, you see that it isn't a matter of class or wealth or anything else that demands of a man that he have good behavior, but rather his respect for others.
Folks, you can read an excerpt of Brad Miner's new book called The Complete Gentleman at the website for Spence Publishing, www.spencepublishing.com. That's www.spencepublishing.com. We're talking about the concepts of being a gentleman and chivalry with Brad Miner. He's a former literary editor for National Review, a novelist, a journalist, and a biographer, and executive editor of Bookspan's American Compass Book Club. The book is called The Complete Gentleman, The Modern Man's Guide to Chivalry. Let's talk. It sounds as though what you're describing there is we have taken kind of the casual familiarity of the locker room among men and made it the standard for the way that men deal with one another in the workplace, in the home, elsewhere, and made it the standard for by which men deal even with the fair sex.
No, there's no doubt about it. Everything has been pared down. It begins, I think, well, where does it begin? I mean, that's a hard thing to say. But if you think about the curriculum in many universities, one of the things that characterizes so much of, particularly the teaching of social sciences, is the idea that there are no absolutes, that everything is relative. And relativism is the dominant worldview of the people in the academy. And that spreads out to bring doubt upon everything. And because we reject now, as a culture, the formalities, the traditions, we inevitably fall victim to what is, in sense, the opposite of those things. We push away the formalities and we embrace the informalities. But as I say, the informalities are dangerous because they bring us too quickly into intimacy, or we imagine that they do, with people who may or may not be folks who are going to give us a fair shake, who are going to be our friends. I think if you enter too quickly into friendship, what you imagine to be a friendship, you lose the opportunity to really get to know someone and to develop the most important quality of a friendship, which is trust.
Now, you mentioned the term egoism as what is being expressed by our over-casual dealings with one another. What do you mean by that?
I mean that, formalities in dress, I was thinking about this, I guess I write about it briefly in the book. I'm a big baseball fan, and I like looking at books about the history of baseball. And if you take a look at a photograph of, say, Yankee Stadium or the old Giants Stadium in the 1930s or 40s, you see that almost every man in the stands is wearing a suit and tie. Now, by a certain interpretation, you look at that and say, geez, look, everyone's wearing the uniform. Everyone looks the same. But that's not what was being expressed. What was being expressed was, first and foremost, self-respect, the idea that you would get up and you would carefully dress yourself, so that you would go out into the world and present a sort of an organized, careful appearance to the world. But it also meant that you would allow that space between yourself and others so that it's possible to approach. The thing about the way so many people dress, I'm in my office now at Bookspan, and I'm looking out at Sixth Avenue, and hardly anybody is in a jacket and tie. I mean, it's late in the day now, folks are going home here, but you see so many young people especially who are in shorts, and some of them are barefoot, and the T-shirts are ragged, and that really is, it's being in your face, it's almost an assault. It's a demand that you look at them, piercings and tattoos and all sorts of things that really are an expression of my individuality. I am telling you, these costumes say, that I am what is important. Whereas the more restrained type of dress, the traditional form of dress, it does the opposite. There was an English tailoring firm that used to say that if one of their clients walked out onto the street and someone came up to him and said, "Oh my God, what a beautiful suit you're wearing," that they had failed. What they would want is someone said, "Charles, you're looking very well." And the idea that it enhances the man, but it doesn't send out some sort of extraordinary message of gaudiness and of drawing too much attention to the suit and therefore to some aspect of the man's personality. The thing about restraint is that it gives people an opportunity to get to know the whole person in a proper spirit and in a proper timing.
So how do you respond to someone who says what you're really advocating for is turning back the clock to an age that was more hierarchical, more elitist, especially with respect to men?
Well, I am in favor of an elite, but it has nothing to do with wealth or class or birth or race or any of that. It's a hierarchy of philosophy. It's a hierarchy of quality, and that's all it is. So my answer is that, first of all, I don't really think that what I've written about in the book and these high standards are going to be embraced by many people. I don't have any kind of messianic notion that all of a sudden Americans are all going to be wearing jackets and ties to Yankee Stadium. And frankly, I don't think they should. I think there are certain of the reforms, in essence, that we've made over the years that are better. It's better to be comfortable at a ball game. However, you can still dress well, even though you dress casually.
Does it strike you as odd that in the things where we have retained these things, you talk about baseball, it is a sport steeped in tradition. They recently talked about putting advertisements on the uniforms, and baseball fans said absolutely not.
Right.
Perhaps they couldn't articulate the reason why. But in sport, in our religious services, we do retain, in the court, we do retain some of the formalities, vestiges of the old chivalry, perhaps without even understanding why or what we're doing.
In the case of baseball, which is always a good example, I think, particularly when you're talking about American things, it's the level playing field. It is, too, a hierarchy, isn't it? I mean, because it's a group of highly talented men who get together to play an extremely difficult sport and do it brilliantly. And they all play by the same rules. And they play by rules that are essentially, although not completely, unchanged. But our rules should always change. Edmund Burke, the great founder of conservatism, said that a nation without some means of change is without the means of its preservation. You can say that about the individual as well. We do have to adapt, but it's best if we adapt in terms of those things which have proved themselves to be timeless, enduring, and true, as baseball is, in my view.
You mentioned earlier in our conversation that a reverence for God was part and parcel of the original concept, philosophy, and manner of chivalry. How does that translate into the 21st century? How does this reverence for God in the 21st century man play into his modern chivalry?
Well, there are two aspects to the complete gentleman's character that it seems to me pretty much depend on religion, on faith. The first is putting yourself second, recognizing in every moment that we live to serve. We serve first God, we serve others, and then we serve ourselves. And the other thing is that I don't believe, and this is a part of the warrior tradition that's a part of the long and glorious history of chivalry, that it's really possible to embrace all this without keeping death at the front of your mind. You have to recognize that death is present, that each of us will die, and you have to be prepared to die well. And that's something that I know a lot of people find difficult to accept, but it's terribly important. And I don't think that most people can look death in the face, and I'm anthropomorphizing, and I shouldn't, but can really face death without faith.
Finally, for a postmodern man, how do we regain the mind and practice of chivalry?
I think the thing first and foremost is to study it, think about it, to try and recall what these principles were, to think about things like loyalty and generosity, courtesy, honor, and courage. John McCain, Senator McCain, has a new book out called Why Courage Matters. It's a good place to start. To think about the men and women who are in the military service and serving us so wonderfully, about their courage and their commitment. To remember those things, and then particularly for fathers, to try and teach these principles, these values to their sons, to offer them the kind of reading, whether it's, you know, some of the old books about the Knights of the Round Table or some of the other glorious stories of Sir Walter Scott's novels, you know. And I really think that the crucible of chivalry is the family. We can't expect schools to do this, and I don't have any hope that they will. But a father can do it. A father, by setting an example of kindness, loving courtesy to his wife, the mother of his children, to by establishing carefully the friendships that he has in his life, by bringing restraint into every aspect of life. And it's certainly important when you think about all the things that press in on our children, television and you know, the kind of awful stuff that so many kids are just given to watch because their parents have deferred the raising of their kids to teachers and to television, and that can't happen.
Brad Miner, thank you very much for being our guest on Issues Etc.
Thank you for having me.
Brad Miner is author of the book The Complete Gentleman, The Modern Man's Guide to Chivalry. You can browse before you buy at www.spencepublishing.com or order the book by calling Spence Publishing at 1-888-SPENPUB. That's 1-888-SPENPUB. Tomorrow on Issues Etc., a two-hour discussion on Christ-centered theology, Christ-centered cross-focused theology. Pastor Daniel Preuss, first vice president of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod and author of our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for May, will be our guest. The book is Why I Am a Lutheran, Jesus at the Center. Then, Sunday night on Issues Etc., we'll talk with Dr. Art Just of Concordia Theological Seminary about the first Pentecost. Some of the things we'll be dealing with on that evening. Oh my goodness, think about this. Is Pentecost, is it the birthday of the church? Is it an ongoing event in the church? What was it really about? Was it about the Holy Spirit, or was it really about Jesus Christ? That's the first Pentecost with Dr. Art Just of Concordia Theological Seminary, Sunday night from 10 to 11 on 91.5 FM here in St. Louis. An interesting conversation with Brad Miner there. Chivalry, it sounds like really just regaining what it means to live as a man in your Christian vocation, in service of God by faith and your neighbor in love. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.